April, what do we have here? Is it March? We're still in March, aren't we?
We're still thinking.
March 20th, it seems like. Agenda for the Senate Committee on Revenue. Today we have one bill before us. It's Senate Bill 397. I'm going to ask Paul to do a little bit of informational work for the committee, sort of the good of the order. He'll be announcing some activities that we intend to take outside of the building, to take our committee meeting on the road. So we'll go ahead and have him do the good of the order, and then we'll come back to Senate Bill 397, a bill that we've heard before. So, Paul, if you could make the announcements on our anticipated journey.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we've made arrangements for a joint meeting with the House Revenue Committee on Monday, April the 9th. And it will be in Lake Oswego at the Metro Center Council Chamber. You've got the address there, and the agenda should be in front of you there. The topic there will be one that most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with, and it was a major issue last session, and that is adjustments in the apportionment of formula for corporate income tax purposes for multi-state companies. And there are really four bills. One, a Senate bill introduced by Senator Beyer, is Senate Bill 614. And then there's three House bills that deal with that subject as well, House Bill 2281, 2550, and 2558. So there'll be a public hearing on those bills, and that's a major policy issue, so I think you'll get a lot of good public testimony on that. So the plan is to go to 4:30, for that Monday.
And colleagues, this will be again a joint meeting with the Senate and the House Committee, so it'll be an opportunity for us to connect, meet our colleagues from the House side, talk about a tax incident model that I think will be a very interesting consideration, since it directly affects many of the Oregon-based companies and many of the companies that do business here. Like many of the other issues, I'm certain there'll be a winners-losers list published as a result of the proposals, but I think it'll make for an interesting opportunity for us to hold a hearing in the Portland metro area, where lots of folks will be directly affected by the consideration of these House bills and will be. So I think it's going to be a good opportunity. So again, mark your calendars for Monday, April the 9th.
The other thing, Mr. Chair, I'd like to mention is I've also put the summary packet from Friday's meeting of the House Revenue Committee on release of the Oregon Tax Incidence Model. All of you have received a copy of the full document, but I thought also it might be helpful to have the summary packet. So I've given you that, and feel free to ask me any questions you have about the model and how it will work. The Chair mentioned these apportionment formula bills. That is an appropriate area for use of the OTM model. We also plan to use it on Representative Shatterly's proposal for a business activity tax, which is another, it's most effective, I think, at looking at these major macro kinds of proposals and looking at how the economy will respond and how the distribution of the tax burden may change in response to those proposals. But I think you'll find it a useful tool for analyzing major proposals.
The issue of who pays taxes in Oregon has been one hotly debated around various rooms in the Capitol building and other places. Who pays the taxes? How heavily the burden falls? How much shifting is there, really, in Oregon's tax model? And also, how does Oregon compare with other places and other states that have similar or dissimilar tax structures? So if you don't find the answer in the summary, look to the report. It's about an inch thick. It's pretty good data, and if you get up a tree with that information, then talk to one of the staff members in revenue who will explain their portion of the incidence model to you.
If you get up a tree and start on it, you'd be asleep before.
Asleep and confused.
And that's just in the committee meeting. Mr. Vice Chair.
Curiosity question, Paul. For a complex proposal like Shatterly's, do you run each of those elements separately through the incidence model?
Senator Beyer, you can certainly look at those in an incremental way, and we will look at really the shift to the new base, which is the business activity base. We'll look at that separately and get a sense of what impact that would have. But I think it is important to recognize that the plan itself is designed to call for a major shift in revenue sources. So we'll look at it in terms of that business activity tax initially, but then also look at the entire package so that you end up with essentially the same size public sector, same size tax burden, and see how the distribution of that tax burden may change and see what the feedbacks effects may be from combining those two, combining the income tax reductions with the business activity or consumption tax increases. Keep in mind that the model is for tax increases will show negative economic feedback effects because you're changing prices and returns to investment and labor in the model. So you do have a negative feedback effect from tax increases, a positive from tax decreases. But in combination, the two of them, as in this proposal, it's not clear what those feedback effects would be, and that, I think, is the biggest interest we have right now in thinking about that as an entire package.
And the model is capable of taking this, every time looking at this, rather complex, there's about eight changes in these proposals.
Yes, the proposal itself, which is House Bill 3942, will reduce income taxes in a number of ways. There's a refundable earned income credit in it. There is a reduction in capital gains. There's a reduction in the top marginal rate. But we can model all those, I think, pretty well. The most problematic piece for us in terms of modeling is the capital gains piece because there is an element to that we really have to look at outside the model.
Senator Corcoran.
Well, just along those lines, I had asked you about the same question that Lee did earlier about separating out the component parts and the other question I had, Paul, sort of process-wise, is if we look at the tax incident model data that you gave us previously, and you look, for instance, at what was in the papers today, it reports income groupings, I don't know, $10,000 apart or something. Mm-hmm. And what we would see is when you do the OTIM analysis of Shetterly's proposal, then we can sort of use the model, the information that we saw today as sort of the baseline and see where the shift takes place with Shetterly's proposal in terms of income classes?
Yes, Senator Corcoran, that's correct. The OTIM model is based on eight different income classes, with the top one being incomes above $126,000, mm-hmm. And the bottom group being households. These are household incomes below $14,000, and that distribution does include capital gains income, which we've built into the model. So if you look on page 5 of that summary packet, this is what Senator Corcoran's referring to. You can see the distribution of the tax burden, which has what we consider a regressive element to it at the tail, at the low end. Other than that, it's essentially proportional with a progressive a piece at the end as the income tax becomes more dominant as a source of revenue for the higher income people. So, yeah, we'll be able to look at this. This is our baseline. This is our current system. So we'll look at that in comparison to what may happen for any major proposals, which I think is the real advantage of this. We can look at the economic effects and how that may change incentives in the system and overall employment and income, but also we can look at how that tax burden will change given the assumptions of the model.
Great, thanks.
Colleagues, we have on the agenda a bill that we've heard before, Senate Bill 397. I'd like to open up the public hearing on 397, reconnect with the principal witnesses on 397, and it's the chair's intention to move the bill today if we have the votes to do that.
Just do the work.
So we'll do that. We'll open up the public hearing on 397. We have some folks here that are here to testify. Could I bring up Mr. Miller from OGIA, Mr. Wilson from NFIB?
Good Good morning, Chair Farioli and members of the committee. I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the National Federation of Independent Business here in Oregon. My membership exceeds about 13,000 right now. The fundamental premise that we work under with bills dealing with the UI system is that NFIB members believe foremost in the integrity of the UI Trust Fund. We believe the fund exists solely to help those who are unemployed through no fault of their own. We don't promote anything that would threaten the solvency of the fund. But because the UI program is funded through an employer payroll tax, we believe it's right that employers obtain the benefit when the trust fund has more than it needs. There are a couple bullet points with regard to this bill because you've heard from the Employment Department. The accepted 18-month solvency standard, which I might add incorporates a worst-case recession scenario, requires that the fund have a balance of about $1.38 million. The current balance of the fund is actually closer to $1.75. There's obviously a gap there, and we think employers should obtain some of that when the fund has more than it needs. Employers obviously finance the trust fund, and so we again believe in that they should obtain the benefit. Another thing I'd like to draw your attention to is that the rate jump between Schedule 2 and 3 in the current schedule is a 42% jump, and right now Oregon employers are in Schedule 2. The current minimum, which the plurality of my employers are actually at, somewhere between 35% and 40% of my small employers actually pay the minimum rate. The minimum rate jumps from 0.7 to 1%, which is about a 42% jump. Even more burdensome is the jump between Schedules 3 and 4 at the current minimum level, which is a whopping 50%. The proposal in Senate Bill 397 actually smooths this out, which I think is a benefit to small business, by decreasing the gap between Schedules 2 and 3 to 28% and the gap between Schedule 3 and 4 to 33%. I'd also like to make note that Oregon's UI system is forward-funded for a good reason, and that is in exchange for relatively high rates during a strong economy. UI rates are held down in the instance of a weak economy, which I think is good economic sense, and the Senate Bill 397 is consistent with this forward funding philosophy. And finally, I'd like to bring up that because the UI Trust Fund is a dedicated fund, it obviously has no impact on the state's general fund. I know there's been some concern that in the instance of a weak economy and reserves are drawn down to an unacceptable level, that perhaps Senate Bill 397 is not prudent in light of that. My response is that, of course, there is plenty of recourse. That is why you have 8 tax schedules within the UI the tax system. It would be simply a matter of moving from Schedule 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 5. Senate Bill 397, I believe, helps in this regard by smoothing out that transition from its current state. And so that self-balancing system, I would hope, would allay some concerns about the prudence of this measure at this time. But NFIB Oregon does support Senate Bill 397, would appreciate your support as well.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Miller, I represent the Oregon Grocery Industry Association. We also support Senate Bill 397, obviously to ease the burden of shifting schedules. As JL stated, in the grocery industry as well, we are at the low experience level, and on most of our members are on that minimum within the schedule. The 42 to 50% jump in schedules from 2 to 3 is obviously a big hit in an industry that has a 1% margin. If you remember, the grocery industry does have a 1% margin. It's on volume. And any kind of hit on taxes is a big hit to the grocery industry. And so this bill, Senate Bill 397, does ease that burden, and we support it. Would like to say, Mr. Chair, it is nice to have the Employment Department come in with a bill that lowers rates. That's not often the case in this process, and so we appreciate the department coming in with a bill like this that we can support, because it's most of the time it's the opposite. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the committee, from the committee to the panels? Hearing and seeing none, I'd like to call Mr. Tim Nesbitt. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony this morning. Appreciate it.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. And we're here in opposition to Senate Bill 397 and want to share with you what our concerns are. First, we'd ask this question. Why commit to reduce funding for unemployment benefits starting 2 years from now, which is when these schedules are projected to first take effect, when we've yet to determine whether existing benefits will be adequate to meet the needs of laid-off workers in the interim? If benefit improvements are needed, we would hope they could be funded with revenues generated by the existing unemployment insurance rate structure without having to raise employer rates. But a reduction in the current schedule rates would make it more difficult to accomplish that. Secondly, why change a schedule of rates that has been in place for years, maintained stable reserves, works to reduce employer rates in times of high employment, and raises those rates when needed to replenish reserves, and does so without having to come back to you for decisions on when to change rates and by how much? This is a formula that works. It produced a $90 million savings for employers this year based on those objective actuarial calculations that underlie the current system. And that happened without controversy or objection, without having to come to you for a bill to lower employer rates. So why tamper with this system? Our biggest concern, and I've submitted previous testimony in writing through my staff person, Steve Lanning, at your last meeting, which you may have seen, and a lot of what I have here in writing repeats that. But our biggest concern is that what you're basically doing is tightening up the margins so that you'd be, in future years, a lot closer to tipping costs to where employers would have to pay more by going from one rate schedule to a higher rate schedule under Senate Bill 397 than you would if you left the current system in place. Some data provided by the Employment Department shows that in the year 2004, employers under the current schedule would be within $25 million of having to be bumped to a higher rate schedule. Under Senate Bill 397, the gap is only $7 million. So there's a lot of margin for error, and in fact, a lot of tightening up of that margin for error in future years if you adopt Senate Bill 397. And our concern here is that we really haven't yet seen the bottom of this recession. We haven't yet gotten a handle on the severity and duration of the layoffs, which we're now seeing. They're quite substantial. Over 7,000 manufacturing jobs we've documented have been lost in the last 9 months. We have a system in Oregon that doesn't provide any benefits beyond the basic 26 weeks. Other states provide extended benefits for workers, at least in high-impacted sectors of their economy. In Washington State, there are benefits available for up to 104 weeks. So it's not just the question of what's the status of the fund now and could we survive a recession. It's also a question of what level of benefit should we be providing to laid-off workers, especially in times of energy crisis, downturns in the economy, and surging imports, which are likely not only to result in short-term layoffs, but long-term layoffs of the kind that, in fact, dislocate workers who are off for extended periods of time and need extended retraining. There are a number of bills we hope will be before other policy committees of this assembly, which will be addressing that question of what should we do longer term for dislocated workers. We don't want to see the ability to fund an improved benefit system for those workers compromised or the funding tightened at a time when we've yet to resolve what is the appropriate response, what are the needs of those workers, and what should we expect by way of benefits from our unemployment insurance system. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Senator Beyer.
Jim, can you talk a little bit about the differences between the Washington State retraining programs and Oregon's and their rates?
In Oregon, as in any state in the country, you can get extended benefits if you qualify under the Trade Act or NAFTA. If your jobs are displaced, if they can be shown to have been displaced because of effects of foreign trade, that's like in all states. However, unless that's the finding, and unless one can access that source of funding, benefits in Oregon cut off at 26 weeks, whether or not you're in a training program. In Washington State, they extend for as long as 104 weeks, depending on the industry and the type of training program you're in.
Is that a diversion, or is that just a difference in the state law?
I believe it's a difference in state law. In the last session of the legislature in Washington State, they approved both an employer rate reduction and an extension of benefits of the kind I described.
Other questions? Mr. Nesbitt, I really appreciate the position you have as the president of the AFL-CIO in Oregon. I think it's important that we heed the concern in terms of your vigilance and the questions that you brought here with your testimony. I've been concerned about layoffs in the aluminum industry since that is 600 of the very best jobs in the state of Oregon in that Mid-Columbia corridor. I represent timber-dependent communities that have suffered huge layoffs, and we're about to watch the trade agreement between Canada and the U.S. Run out, although it never did protect American workers. The lack of that agreement raises huge concerns for all of us, I think, in timber-dependent communities. And we would be foolish not to look at the costs. Everywhere we go, we hear about the cost of energy, the increases in the cost of energy and what that does to businesses. And obviously, there's two ways to look at every question. Should we not, if we have the opportunity, cut the costs to business, which are passed to all consumers? Should we not make the automatic switching between rates easier, knowing that if we get into a situation that is a further erosion of the economic picture in Oregon, shouldn't we have a easier transition from 3 to 4 if we need to go back there? But we do have a situation where the reserves are high, and maybe unjustifiably high. If we get to the place where the automatic unemployment rates increase from Class 3 to 4, if we get to the place where it looks like we need to do a significant extension of benefits, I'm going to also predict that we're in the place where we do significant budget cuts and we come back in legislative session. In other words, we're at the fork in the road with the economy. Either the thing stays a little bit flat, we're on a glide path, and that's sort of what people that are informing this process are predicting. And if they're wrong, and the folks from the Employment Division are staking their professional reputations on the fact that they're not wrong in proposing this reduction, then I think we have a problem that brings us back into the building anyway. So I understand what you're bringing to us. I feel the reality of the employment situation in rural communities, perhaps more than they do in urban communities, because I've seen these people. I know their situation. The layoffs are real. They're not hypothetical. And I don't, even though some of our aluminum workers are furloughed, it's terrifying for a family. But it's also very rare that we have an agency that's clearly bringing information that they have absolute certainty that they can meet the worst case scenario for unemployment benefits. Got questions?
I'm trying to clear my mind, Tim. Where you come from. You're not arguing that the fund, it's an insurance fund, that it shouldn't work on an actuarial basis. I think what I'm hearing you saying is that before you make a change based on current benefits, the legislature ought to consider whether it should change those benefits?
That's correct. I'm not questioning the Employment Department's actuarial projections. I don't have a basis for doing that. In fact, I accept those projections. What I'm saying is they're basing their projections on current benefits. And the impact of the layoffs we're seeing now, and these are not just seasonal and short-term. We believe these are this is an increase in dislocation of workers who are going to need retraining and extended benefits. Raises the question that we should consider, we believe, extending the benefits, at least for certain categories of workers. That's going to mean more cost. The Employment Department has not, and it's not their role to presume that in their calculations. We're saying there are a number of proposals that we've advanced in this session. There's a problem out there. There's a need to be met, perhaps in part with extended benefits. And we would hope that before you make this commitment to reducing rates based on actuarial projections of current benefits, that you look seriously at the need for enhancing benefits for dislocated workers.
I'm not arguing at this point for higher benefits, just a change to allow for a longer period for some workers that are dislocated.
Yes, but that would have cost.
I understand that. As I understand it, Oregon's benefits are not the highest, but they're on the high end in terms of weekly for the period when you can draw them as a worker.
And extending those would entail cost. And we're very sensitive about any proposal we bring to your committee or any other committee, which would in fact generate a increase in employer rates because it tips the scales from one schedule to the next. We're on the margin right now between schedules. We see ourselves being closer to those margins in future years. If you adopt this reduction, we'd rather ask that you hold off and look at those margins and the ability to fund some benefits in cases where they're most compelling, benefit improvements.
Are there discussions going on now about changing that benefit package?
Yes, there are, and there are bills submitted in both houses to do so.
You referenced in your letter that the committee, the advisory committee is meeting next week, or is it this week?
Thursday of this week.
Thursday of this week. Are they going to be taking up that subject?
We're going to be looking at a large number of bills and attempting to, I think, arrive at recommendations on as many as we can.
So the potential that we might see a recommendation coming for them to make a change?
I would hope so.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Nesbitt.
Thank you.
I'd like to call forward Lisa Trussell, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and we're here today in support of Senate Bill 397. Our members are very appreciative that the Employment Department brought this bill forward. As you are aware, the Unemployment Compensation Trust Fund is funded through an employer payroll tax, and we currently pay a tax on the first $25,000 of wages that a worker earns. Oregon, with the support of business and labor, established a forward funding system so that taxes would not have to be raised during an economic downturn when employers could least afford an increase. At the last hearing, you heard in detail how the rates were figured. The Employment Department looks at the last 10 years on a rolling basis and tries to calculate the worst experience during that period. And benefits should be available for 18 months under that scenario. It's our understanding that the fund holds enough currently to fund 22 months at the level of recession we saw in 1975. Another way of stating is we have $200 million more dollars than we need for a hit like we had in 1975. The impact of this change will be felt in the future, and most critically probably is when the schedules would have to go from Schedule 3 to Schedule 4. There are 8 tax tables, and a formula is used periodically to determine which of the 8 tax tables we should be using. And it's our understanding that in 1995, the legislature adjusted tables 1 through 3. Senate Bill 397 adjusts 3 of the 8 tax tables downwards. But if you'll notice, the bill before you on tax table 5 would be the same as the current tax table 4. And this is made possible by a number of factors, including investments earnings generated over the last several years. The adjustment in the tables will moderate the impact on businesses when it becomes necessary to move between tables 3 and 4. On behalf of our members, AOI urges your support of Senate Bill 397. Thank you.
Question? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Lisa, speaking about Tim Nesbitt's comments, would AOI be supportive of, as they were in the past, of a dislocated worker adjustment program for these severe economic dislocations?
Well, I think if we had a situation similar to what we had in the past, that it would be something that we'd consider.
You don't think we have that now?
I'm not sure we have that yet. I mean, that was a specific group that was affected, and I'm not sure that we have the same situation now.
If we did?
If we did, I'm sure that we'd be considering it.
Further questions? Hearing none. Thank you, ma'am. Let's have a wrap-up by the agency folks. You've heard the testimony. We want to make sure the committee has the opportunity to ask any further questions they may have. So, Ms. Crosley, please come up.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, I'm Berlina Crosley, the director of the Oregon Employment Department, and I think both sides that have been presented well, so I don't have anything more to comment. I would, to Senator Byer's earlier discussion or questions about the Washington State, they did pass a tax reduction bill, and at the same time, it was primarily Boeing that was doing major layoffs, and they mitigated some of the concerns around the layoffs there with some training and some extensions of benefits. You ask about whether they would be a diversion. They were not. They would be very much like we used to have in Oregon, where we had a $12 million cap that we paid out of the trust fund. If we were to do something like that in Oregon based on a dislocated worker extension, we could go up to $7 million without kicking into a new tax table based on the bill that's before you. And that would be covered out of the trust fund.
Say that again.
You would have a cap of $7 million, and then you could extend benefits, but it would take a legislative change to allow that for dislocated workers. Even in the worst dislocations that we had in the early 1990s, for primarily timber-based, we had $12 million cap, and it took us two bienniums to spend those $12 million. So,
as I recall, because I did quite a bit of work on dislocated worker programs, and we passed some laws in the early 90s for that, it seemed like one of the issues that we had was that their UI ran out before they could legitimately complete.
We extended the $12 million, extended their benefits, 13 additional weeks, so they could have a total of 39.
Which is what, less than Washington State did, right?
Right. And at the same time, in the early 90s, they were also going into extended benefits because the state in total had a higher unemployment rate than we currently do. So we actually did have people at that time having benefits up to almost a year. But the $12 million cap that the Employment Department administered through extended benefits was 13 weeks. Without the federal help on that, 13 weeks.
Do you have a sense if we tried to, restricting it to dislocated workers, if we were trying to change to allow, like Washington State, the 104 weeks, could we do that within the funding that we have available?
We have not costed that out. We would need to know who you were trying to target. For example, in the legislation that was passed in the early 90s, it did target timber, timber-related. And you would have to tell us who you were trying to target to be able to...
My sense is what we're going to see in the next year, 2 years, are going to be another hit on timber, as Senator Farioli has talked about, as a result of the NAFTA issues. I know I'm hearing that already in my district.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't really thought about it until this morning. And energy-related, I think you're going to lose a whole lot of heavy energy-dependent industries, particularly the aluminum industries. Probably a fairly narrow focus point.
Right. Mr. Chair,
5,000, 6,000 jobs.
Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, we have, I didn't bring those with me, but we do have recent updates on the layoffs and projections on the energy relationship because we're working with the governor's cabinet on that particular issue. The numbers are nowhere near currently. They are nowhere near the early timber-related issues now. Right, but they are there. There has been major layoffs because of that.
Would that be something that your staff could look at quickly and give some feedback to the committee?
Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, absolutely.
How much time would it take to do that, too?
We could do it this week. Everything that we have, we could bring to you. And I do know that they are looking at that issue.
In your professional opinion, would it be prudent to look at that, given the situation we're in?
My professional opinion is that the numbers that we're seeing, while they're major layoffs that are occurring, they're masked by the total unemployment rate.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was not true in the early 1990s. So you have that difference. I have not seen any numbers that would say that it's anywhere compared to the early 90s for the timber. But if you extended benefits to those, my guess, you know, just now, it would not be that much money. In other words, the $7 million gap between the schedules would certainly be relevant.
My guess is in the relative state of employment in the state, a layoff in Portland is no big deal, but if you're a 50,000-plus employee at the aluminum plant in the Dells and they're seeking retraining, that's a pretty big shock.
It is, yes. And we do have it broken down by the parts of the state. But generally speaking, the numbers that I just saw last week, even those layoffs are mostly in the I-5 corridor, the timber-related ones. Or excuse me, the natural
I wonder if this isn't worth looking at. I'm inclined to very much to support this, but I wonder if that might be worth looking at. I haven't thought about dislocated workers for a few years, but I worked very closely with them in the early 90s, and I know what it meant to those families.
And it's good to reconnect with our roots. let me ask a few questions. And I appreciate the record that you've created with your questions, but let me ask other questions as well. The reality in the mid-Columbia area of located workers in the aluminum industry is that there are no retraining opportunities available to those workers. They're either in the aluminum industry or they're out of the community. So, and interestingly, the labor issues that were brought before us by Mr. Nesbitt, there's a huge role that labor will play in these issues, and that is that labor consumed will be directly connected with constructing the new power facilities that will generate the power capacity that earns our way and generates our way out of the gridlock situation we're in with availability of power. Labor will have a big issue to play there. The question about how those plants get put in, how quickly they get put in, certainly will impinge on the question of whether or not we can retain the aluminum industry in the mid-Columbia. But we have to also look at this issue. Ms. Crosley, your professional opinion is that we're over-collecting taxes from our unemployment taxpayers, our employers. And in your professional opinion, which you stated for the record, is that this accrual rate is sort of anachronistic. It's a hangover from a period when we had very volatile swings in employment and had potentially gotten to this place because of the huge dislocations in the 70s. And we're still sort of locked in the mentality that we see those big swings. And that under no circumstances that you can forecast to UCS using the reserves that we've piled up in this fund. Now, have I misstated any of your professional conclusions?
No, Mr. Chair, you have not.
Okay, so at
the current benefit levels. And so your recommendations, notwithstanding the questions and notwithstanding the advisory committees, et cetera, notwithstanding the other bills that may come before this legislature, your recommendation is that we are over-collecting these taxes and that we could very easily afford to go from level 4 to level 3. Or at least we'll smooth the transition, and that we need the principles embodied in Senate Bill 397 to accomplish the goal. So nothing has changed as a result of the questioning from the committee, and it's still your professional opinion that we can do this.
Yeah, that is correct, Mr. Chair.
And I guess I could drive this point more completely home if I haven't already. It's your professional opinion, and you're fully aware of the consequences of a miscalculation here.
Too well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I thought you might be. The other thing is, I think you ought to really look at this. We're not talking about spending this trust fund. This $1.75 billion will remain available to pay benefits.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the benefits are a dedicated fund, and yes, they are there to pay benefits.
No sneaky strategy to move this into the general fund or spend it on remodeling the Capitol building, a new facility for the employment.
I have no feeling whatsoever to do that, and frankly would have very anti-feelings against it.
Okay. And in point of fact,
the legality problem.
Yes. Right. I think I would not like to be in jail.
So, and if we do encounter a situation where unemployment is higher than projected, won't we automatically go into a higher category?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we would. It is a self-balancing fund.
And if the benefits are extended through the passage of any of the suite of legislation mentioned in the Mr. Nesbitt's testimony, Senate Bill 319, House Bill 3759, any of the other legislation that would extend the benefits, wouldn't you have to take those things into consideration as well? And wouldn't that make an automatic rate adjustment if necessary?
Yeah, depending on the amount, the fiscal impact, yes, it could move us quicker to one of the other tax schedules.
Okay. Correct. Colleagues, I don't see a downside in moving Senate Bill 397. I see that we've inherited a system that's over-accrued in light of the current situation and the projected situation, even in the worst-case scenario. I see that there are multiple layers of safeguards that are automatic. You know, if we have a higher incidence of unemployment or we have an extension of benefits in this legislative session, those changes from our classes are going to be automatic. They're connected to the need. I just really think that it's prudent of us to take the consideration of the agency into effect, support Senate Bill 397, and move it forward. I just do not see a downside here, notwithstanding the fact that there are people arranged all around this issue that might have another opinion. Senator, your hand is up, but I noticed that Senator Minnis had a question earlier. Senator Minnis, do you have a question?
Not a question, just a statement. The idea that somehow the aluminum industry in the Columbia Corridor is going to somehow reemerge is a false one, at least on the Oregon side of the river, because the metals plant is in my district, and it's closed down permanently, and it's not going to reopen, and there's a substantial reason why that's the case, and they've not retrofitted their plant.
You're referring to the facility there in Gresham.
Yeah. Is there another aluminum smelter
there
on the Oregon
side? There
actually
are two more, a little further east of you in the Columbia area.
Really?
One in Dallas, and the other one right across the river.
Oh, I was going to say, I really could care less about the aluminum industry because they're all on the Washington side.
Oh, no, I love the aluminum industry.
They're all on Chester.
And notwithstanding that, 600 jobs in the corridor, I think you'd have real difficulty separating the economic impact from a Washington aluminum worker, from an Oregon aluminum worker, because the river is more of a bridge of commerce than it is a barrier.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, there are other international phenomena occurring in terms of the creation of aluminum at lower prices. You know, basically our industries are having a very difficult time competing with the international markets, and for good reason. Our labor costs are very, very high. So I was just going to, I guess, speak with respect to the Reynolds metals facility. It isn't going to reopen. It's going to become up.
We've got a pretty committed gentleman who runs a plant in Golden Nail in the Dalles. He's going to, he has plans on the drawing board to add 350 megawatts of energy into that corridor to support the aluminum industry. So yeah, we're hopeful that happens.
Not going in my district.
Well, we'll put the power in the grid. Senator Byer.
But you have some other industries that are affected that aren't just aluminum. I have a silica plant in my district, that's...
A what?
Silica.
What's
that? Well, metallurgy that's there, and you have, I would hope you wouldn't forget, you have, Senator, a number of semiconductor plants in your area that are next to aluminum, the largest users of power, and are just as a threat as the aluminum industries in Senator Perioli's district.
Well,
there's a huge risk that's there. That may require some retraining.
Well, I guess what I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, is that you...
And it's not the plant,
those
the
folks
people
that are,
who held the job.
Those other industries have a higher level of education and training currently than do the traditional Reynolds aluminum workers. And I know that because my uncle worked at the Reynolds plant for 40 years. And I graduated in that sixth grade, but that's not the case today for a lot of workers.
Actually, those workers in the mid-Columbia... I think the issue for us is you better protect the jobs that are in that community. Because if those jobs go away, I don't know what alternatives those families have in that local community. Colleagues, I want to use the committee's time to the best efficiency. Senator Byer had his hand up. We'll take that. And Senator Castillo. But my intention is to go to work session on that.
Very clear, though. I need to understand this, really. If subsequent to movement of this bill, the benefits were altered by the legislature, such as in Washington State. Would that just move from one schedule to another one, or would you have to come back and ask us to adjust the rate scales?
Mr. Chair, depending on how the legislation is drafted, generally speaking, we would not have to come back. It would, as long as you authorize the benefits to be paid out, then they are what we would put in our calculation, and then it would adjust automatically. The tax schedules would adjust automatically.
So just push it up, it would just cause, and this way the schedule or the proposal works is you're not giving any money back, you're just reducing the rates.
They become effective in 2003, that is correct.
So you just raise the, you just jump from a 2 to maybe jump, instead of from 2 to 3, 2 to 4?
But we would be collecting slower because we would not be collecting at the current rate. So it would just slow that down.
Can I ask your question another way, Senator?
You can try.
What I'm seeing and hearing is that nothing in Senate Bill 397 in any way prejudices the case for extended benefits. And if extended benefits are authorized, then the schedule will automatically be adjusted to account for those extended benefits.
That is correct.
That's what I'm saying.
So that doesn't change your actuarial assumptions?
I'm sorry?
It doesn't change your actuarial assumptions.
Right. The solvency standard is still there, and the factors that we consider in law are still there. So if, for example, you changed the law and made certain people eligible for benefits that aren't currently eligible or for a longer period, those would become current law, and then we would make those a part of the assumptions, and we would project the rates based on those.
So effectively what you're doing is just smoothing the rate schedule?
That's effectively what we're doing, correct.
It doesn't affect the passage. It's just how quickly you go up again. I mean, effectively what you've done the last couple of years because of over-collections and higher interest earnings is you've dropped down from the standards level for Schedule 4.
Correct.
And we've dropped to Schedule 2 because of the over-recovery.
Correct. The way we have proposed it hasn't even changed the timing based on the amounts that we're talking about, but it could. This one just happens to not do that, but it does definitely make the adjustment to those schedules when we do go into them a softer piece for the employers to pay and still keep the safe solvency standard that we have.
And that's an automatic insurance trigger that
it is an automatic.
Deal with. It's not the legislature, so if we change something, you're essentially looking at an 18-month reserve.
18-month reserve.
18-month
and that's
reserve.
Been, you know, for since the 1970s. I mean, a long time.
30 years.
Right.
Colleagues, you know, I'm sorry to test you.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Does this proposal include continuing the Jobs Plus program that we currently have, we have had?
Mr. Chair and Senator Castile, no.
But there is a proposal this session to continue the Jobs Plus program.
There is a bill that would do so.
And how much is that to the fund?
There's two parts of that answer. There is a substantive bill that's on the Senate side that does not have the tax rates associated with it, and then the House side has a bill that does that. The amounts that we have calculated would be about $110 million over five or six years, and that would be a diversion.
And so if this bill passes and that bill passes, those bills pass, what happens to the rates?
Unless they're changed, and I haven't looked at that this week, but unless they change the way they calculate it so they would shift the tax collections out into the future a little bit, which is why it was over the 6 years,
okay.
It would not trigger a tax rate increase as well.
Okay.
Any other questions? Colleagues, I think we've given this bill adequate consideration. Some people may believe we've heard more than we needed to, but I don't agree. I think we've heard what we need to hear to come to a prudent conclusion. So I'm going to open the work session on this bill. The work session up on Senate Bill 395, the chair will consider a motion.
Mr. 397?
397. Excuse me. Let the record be corrected to show that the chairman misspoke. This is a work session on Senate Bill 397.
I move Senate Bill 397 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 397 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions on the motion? Do you have objections to the motion?
Mr. Chair, go ahead.
Senator Corcoran and Senator Castillo. Senator Castillo is recognized.
This is a tough one for me, very tough, because, I very much appreciate how well our fund is managed and have a lot of confidence in those who are managing this fund. And it's the reason why we have one of the strongest funds in the country. But there are a lot of good issues here that I think that do need to be considered still, and we have a number of proposals pending in the legislature that could affect the rates as well and could affect the fund. And I just think we're being kind of jumping ahead a little too quickly on making this adjustment after we've already made a $90 million adjustment earlier this year. So I think I'm going to, for now, take a look at maybe trying to improve this proposal in a minority report. So I'm going to vote no on this for now.
Okay. Duly noted, and we'll let the record show that Senator Castillo serves notices for a potential minority report. Thank you, Senator. Senator Corcoran.
Just to echo what Senator Castillo said, I'll be joining her with the human minority report.
Senator Corcoran offers a ditto to the record. Any further questions?
But not a Russ Limbaugh ditto.
Senator Bryan.
My inclination with reservations, I'd rather not move it today, but I'm supportive of what they're doing. I wonder if, when would this be expected to hit the floor, next week?
I believe the cycle has been about 5 days. I could check with the president and give you a report back.
I would like to make a request to the Employment Department. If you could take a look at what it would take and how it would impact on the shift in the schedules and rates to move to parallel what Washington has done for what you'd perceive, in your professional opinion, to be impacted by the NAFTA changes and the energy crisis. Give me a window of what that would do on that before we get to the floor. I'd appreciate that.
And if Senator Beyer, I may be so bold as just to ask the information to be shared with all committees.
I assume that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You just provide that to committee staff. The clerk will call the roll, please.
No.
Carson. No.
Morris.
Aye.
Menon.
Aye.
Starr.
Aye.
Meyer.
Aye.
Aye. Senator Starr, did you want to carry this one? This is an excellent bill. Okay. And the chair notes the legitimate issues and the concerns that the committee has discussed, and we accept the question of the potential of the minority report in the spirit that it's offered and appreciate the good testimony and the great questions. I think we did justice to this bill, that one for us. But I also think it's a matter of the unusual character of the proposal brought by the Employment Division, that is to lower the tax rate. That's what causes some suspicion among the committee members. So I think it's totally understandable. Senator Kirk.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it also points to this sort of ironic situation we're in that Paul described earlier as sort of unusual for us, which is that because of such a strong economy in the first part of the biennium, we have a kicker kicking on the one hand, and we have a deficit, a huge deficit in terms of current service level on the other. And I appreciate Senator Beyer's comments about the fact that we really should be looking at this in the full picture. And I don't think Ms. Crosley, I mean, they do excellent work over there, but I don't think anybody's in the business of being able to predict not only how this kind of recessionary time looks, but in my mind, more importantly, it's kind of trying to predict within that those family wage jobs. We're not talking about service industry jobs here. We're talking about the best jobs available in the blue collar world and in Oregon, and dislocation and retraining of those folks is a much different burden than trying to create a slave labor program like Jobs Plus, where you move minimally trained people around for 6 months and call it training. So I think that there's legitimate concerns raised here.
Senator Byer, and then Senator George.
Just a reminder and commentary. I mean, this is, mm-hmm. we talk about it as a tax, and technically it is, but really this is an insurance program.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's what you're talking about. It is structured as an insurance program. It's just like a health insurance or mm-hmm. long-term disability, and what you look at is the rate schedule. I mean, I don't like it in my business when my health insurance rates go up either, but there's a reality to that, and I think you can't talk about this or shouldn't talk about this as a tax, although it's an imposed insurance program. You've got to look at it on the actuarial tables and be careful on how you talk about that.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You saw me get up and leave. I hope that was acceptable. I went back to ask Tim Nesbitt a question, and the question was, our industries are in big trouble because we have a very unlevel playing field. First of all, right now we have an energy crisis, which is impacting not only your aluminum plants, but my steel plants. And these are good, family wage jobs. But there's another important thing that maybe would be something this committee could do would be to join with our union colleagues to get a letter back to Congress saying, look, we need a level playing field here. No more truly slave labor in the former Soviet Union or in communist China that is producing products that are being shipped in here below our cost of production. And a lot of time it is flat out dumping. And we need to do something about that. I mean, no one should allow an assault, an attack upon their industry, and I think that's something we ought to speak out about.
Senator George,
this impact is going to be terrific.
I think your commentary is wise, and I think your commentary is well made. The fact is that none of us on this committee wants to look at the aftermath of job loss. We'd rather fight to keep the jobs in place. And you know, the adjustment that we made this morning, I can just move the tax table. It's not a revolutionary change. But I agree with Senator George's comment, and if Mr. Nesbitt wishes to bring such a letter to the committee, I'll certainly share it with members of the Senate and ask for their support for such a letter. I absolutely agree. Too many foreign agencies and foreign governments have dumped products on this production-based economy, and Oregon is still a manufacturing community, and it's time we basically dug in our heels and started to say,
you've been talking to the chair about Nike again.
Colleagues, we have all had an opportunity to express ourselves more than usual in this committee hearing. I think it's just because it's not like a school funding adjustment.
I just want to know if Paul's going to lower the interest rate by half a point today to trade the stock market.
Yes.
That's all I know.
And then on the other hand, Paul, it's time to adjourn the committee. We'll meet again tomorrow morning at 8:30. Thank you.